The topic yesterday was emotions and the positive factors of the mind. Today, it's pain and the negative emotions of the mind. So that's what we'll be sailing into right at this point. Now, pain is an unpleasant, usually unpleasant sensation that people have that stimulates certain parts of the brain in an unpleasant way. When pain affects the brain, large parts of the brain are stimulated, as evidenced by the fact that large parts of the brain get an increased blood supply during the time that the person is having pain. The gray matter gets more blood supply. So this lets us know that pain causes a serious deflection of the normal activity of the brain. Now, affect is a word that you need to know. Affect is that agreeable or disagreeable subjective experience that you have to which you bring forth an emotion. Now, there are some people who have what is called a flattened affect and some people who have a heightened affect. Now, the flattened affect is that the person does not react emotionally to the experiences of life. To give you an example, someone could say, "Your house is on fire," and you would say, "It is." That's a flattened affect. On the other hand, many people have a heightened affect, an affect that is all out of proportion to what would be expected. To give you an example, someone might say, "There, a hair just fell on your collar." It did. Just all out of proportion to the thing that happened. And a lot of times, people react with a heightened affect when it isn't necessary at all. Now, as with all other types of thoughts, we react in the brain with the production of certain neurohormones. Now, you'll recall that a certain special part of the brain we studied was involved with the emotions. Let's just take a review of those parts of the brain involved in the emotions. If we draw the standard psychologist's diagram of mental arrangement with the will up here at the top and the hemispheres right and left with the creative and the scientific hemispheres, then down below we have the limbic system. And what is the limbic system associated with? Emotions, pleasurable things and non-pleasurable things. Also something else very important goes on down there, and what is that? The control of blood pressure, pulse, respiration, and temperature. Those all go on down in the limbic system. Now, if these things, if emotions and these vegetative functions are all controlled by the same part of the brain, then we would expect that there would be a number of things that occur in the limbic system that of a thought nature that would influence these vegetative functions, such as blood pressure, pulse, respiration, and temperature. And we find that indeed that is the case. The temperature may actually go up because of certain emotions that we have. The temperature may go down because of certain emotions that we have. If we are sad or depressed, the temperature is likely to go down in the body. If one is sexually aroused or angry, the temperature of the body is likely to go up somewhat by that. Now we find that certain specific measurable increases or reductions in neurohormones occur, so that serotonin is increased. That's a neurohormone. Serotonin is increased if we have some kind of sedative type of experience. Now, serotonin is a neurohormone that we find increased in sleep. It is also increased when we are very relaxed and enjoying things. And I certainly hope that you do not get too relaxed and get to producing too much serotonin this afternoon, because if you do produce a lot, it can put you to sleep. Now, if we are doing aggressive things, and by that I don't mean combative or pugilistic aggressive things, but aggressive things such as feeding or dressing or doing housework, these kinds of activities cause a production of catecholamines and norepinephrine. And dopamine. Now, you'll recall that dopamine is the neurohormone in short supply in people who have Parkinson's disease. And so we can measure these things almost exactly. Now, let's take a few direct types of emotional experiences. Let's just take grief. Grief is that sense of bereavement or loss that one feels when one has lost a near friend or relative. Now, grief is a negative emotion. It does not build up the body at all. And consequently, we want to experience grief as little as possible. It should not be something that we would cherish and hold on to. All intense emotions bring about serious physical responses, and if they occur suddenly, they can even bring about death. These include such things as anger and acute depression, where it comes on very suddenly, or fear, or even the anticipation of excitement or grief. Interpersonal conflicts of various kinds, on the job or in the home. Marital problems, such as anticipating a marital separation or an actual separation. Business failure or some kind of public disgrace. Any one of these kinds of things can bring on such serious physical disability as to cause sudden death. And there have been many different types of sudden intense emotions associated and reported with sudden death. Bereavement or grief, if it is prolonged for an inordinate period, can bring about depression, nightmares, sleeplessness, headaches, many different types of physical illnesses, and early death. Now, keep in mind about death, and I'm going to talk with you a little bit more about that a little later. Now, the next thing that I'd like to talk about is that of sadness. Now, sadness is different from grief. Sadness is a sort of blue feeling. Blue in the same way that one is blue to be depressed. This emotion, unlike almost all others, will interfere with the normal responses of the heart to exercise. So if you are sad or depressed, the stimulation in the limbic system with the production of certain neurohormones can cause a blanking out of an increase in blood pressure or pulse or respiration or temperature that one would ordinarily and normally expect with intense emotions. Now, anxiety. Anxiety is different from fear. Anxiety is that thing that one feels that has a deadening effect on one. Both anxiety and depression or sadness cause a reduction in the total response that we can expect from both branches of the autonomic nervous system. Now, what are the two big branches of the autonomic nervous system? Parasympathetic and sympathetic. And in sadness or depression and anxiety, there is a reduction in the response in the autonomic nervous system. In other words, with this kind of activity in the limbic system, we have a suppression of the ordinary physiologic responses. Now, let's go to anger. Anger causes a different response from anxiety or depression. Anger causes a strong stimulation of both the autonomic, sympathetic and the parasympathetic divisions of the autonomic nervous system. Now that is anger. Fear, on the other hand, only stimulates the sympathetic. Now, all of these others that I mentioned depress the nervous system. Fear and anger stimulate. Fear stimulates only the sympathetic. Anger stimulates both the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. Stimulates or heightens the response of. Now let's take the Bible and just take a look at three texts. One you'll find in Proverbs 22 and verse 24. Proverbs 22 and verse 24. Here is some very good counsel. Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man thou shalt not go. All right? Does this give us some indication of what our response should be toward anger? If we're not even to have fellowship with an angry man, we're not to take a walk with a person who is angry. We're to make no friendship with an angry person. Does this give us an idea about what our own personal attitude should be toward becoming angry ourselves? Now, I hope you recognize that this flies in the face of ordinary psychological principles. Ordinary psychological principles are anti-biblical in this regard. They teach that if you do not vent anger or fear, that this will cause you to have certain sublimated emotions which gnaw on you down in the depths of your soul somewhere and cause some kind of physical or emotional illness. But such is not the case. That is not really true. The very reverse is the case. Now let's take another one in Proverbs. Let's turn back to Proverbs 14 and verse 17. This lets us know about a hot temper. Verse 17 of chapter 14. He that is soon angry dealeth foolishly. He that is soon angry dealeth foolishly. In other words, if we do not learn to control the temper, then what? We are dealing foolishly, aren't we? Is it just foolishly with other people? No, it is foolishly with yourself. You will find that your own health will be worse if you do not learn to control anger. Now let's turn to Ecclesiastes 7. And let's look at verse 9. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 9. Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of what? Fools. That's right. Anger resteth in the bosom of fools. So anger, we must not tolerate. Yes.
You made a comment that I'd like to expand on.
All right.
Are you saying that a lifestyle counselor or pastor or the people like me should not spend time with the person that is angry?
Okay. Question is, if a person is angry and you're a counselor, can you take a walk with them? Well, of course. I think that what this is referring to is that you would not choose as your friends those who are always angry, who have a habit of being angry. And there are people who are they're angry every day. They're angry several times a day. That's right. They're not happy unless they're angry. They're stirring up something all the time. And there are people who are that way. They're simply not happy unless they're working on some little devious problem of some kind. Now, anger and resentment have the same kind of effect on the nervous system. Now, some of us are not given to anger, but we are given to resentment. We may not have any problem at all in letting ourselves fly off the handle, but we do resent things. Somebody says something to us, and we resent it. In fact, was that not what was going on at the time that the disciples were together at that Last Supper with Jesus? They were resentful because of the fact that there were certain ones who had an inside track, and they really were working at trying to better their position, and they were trying to make themselves get in a position so that they could more readily capitalize on what they knew was the coming kingdom. They wanted to have a good position there. So they worked at it. And some others were resentful. That led to resentment on the part of the others, too. So we had resentment in two parties. Two parties of people were undergoing resentment. Jesus knew what their problem was, and he had the perfect answer, didn't he? He showed that he himself would be their servant. And as he touched them, it did some things to them. Did some very settling things to these people who were having a problem. And I would like to give you some research from Nursing Research. This is a report from Nursing Research, volume 30, page 32, January 1981, for those of you who would like the reference. Tells about certain emotional states, especially anxiety, being relieved by touch. Have you been studying some things about touch during this seminar and the way that massage will assist a person in recovery from disease? Now, we're not speaking of just psychological enjoyment. We're talking about a therapeutic effect of massage. A touch can help greatly with that. Now, sometimes in the family, husbands and wives have a little anxiety with each other. Husband says, this is going to be the way it's going to be. Wife is anxious about that, and she begins to be more and more upset and anxious over it. If he just touches her, often she will just melt, won't she? Healed by a touch. A lot of things can be healed by a touch. Can relieve anxiety quite a great deal. So let us remember that point of the relief of emotional states through a touch. Now fear, let's study fear just a little bit. Fear, as we have already discussed, is not as destructive an emotion, as is anger. Anger is spoken about more in the Bible than is fear, insofar as being afraid is concerned. Let us turn to Psalm 23 and verse 4. Who knows that from memory? Psalm 23 and verse 4. That's right. Let's all quote it together. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. That's a very good thing to know, that God will comfort us when we are afraid. We can depend on that. Now, there is a kind of fear that is healthy. It actually builds the body. It strengthens the spirituality. Let's turn to the Revelation. Revelation 14 and verse 7. This chapter in the Revelation is the great chapter that deals with 144,000, one of them, along with the seventh chapter. Revelation 14 and verse 7. Says, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment is come. And worship Him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. This kind of fear is healthy. It makes such changes in the physiology that those who have a healthy fear of God live longer than other people do. This kind of fear, this fear of God, results in people's recovery better from operations. If they get injured, if they have a healthy fear of God, they will recover from their automobile accidents or any other injury that they have. They will recover from that a lot better. Also, if a person who has a healthy fear of God has a child, that lady will recover from childbirth a lot faster than will another woman who does not have a healthy fear of God. Now, when we are talking about emotions, it would not be well if we didn't tell about the exhaustion of the emotions and the mind by certain activities that bring on a certain depletion of the limbic system. Let's take talking too much. Being talkative is depleting to the brain. Let's just take a couple of texts that will help us to see what the Bible's attitude is toward too much talking. Let's turn to the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 10 and verse 19. Proverbs 10 and verse 19 on the subject of being talkative. In the multitude of words there wanteth not sin, but he that refraineth his lips is wise. Sage counsel, that is, not to be talkative. I remember one time when I was a little girl, I heard somebody say something that I thought was funny at that time, and I'll tell it to you. I'm sure I may not be able to quote it exactly, but probably you have heard it and you can help me to remember what it is. It goes something like this. Better to keep your mouth shut and appear to be a fool than to open it and remove all doubt. Have you heard that? Well, Proverbs says something similar to that in several places. And this particular one is a good prototype of that. But let's turn on over to Ecclesiastes 5. And let's read another very similar statement. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 2. We can see from these the Bible's attitude toward talkativeness. We won't by any means exhaust the subject from the Scriptures. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 2, "Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven, and thou upon earth. Therefore, let thy words be few." Let thy words be few. Now, of the two sexes, male and female, which needs to be the most careful about talkativeness? Women need to be the most careful. Now, there are two reasons for that. One is that we have a language facility. It is a fact, a physiologic fact, that women learn languages better. They tend to have greater vocabularies. They tend to talk more fluently than do men, and a number of other things that have to do with linguistic superiority. The two people that I know who wrote more prolifically than most anybody else are Shakespeare and Ellen White. Shakespeare had used a vocabulary containing 28,000 words. 28,000 words. He was a highly educated man, or Francis Bacon, either one, whichever one you think wrote all those things that are ascribed to Shakespeare. How many words do you suppose this little fourth grade educated lady named Ellen White used in her writings? 33,000. 33,000. So we can be, we can see that when we compare a man and his vocabulary and linguistic abilities with a woman and her vocabulary and linguistic abilities, the man doesn't hold the candle to the woman.
Maybe you should hold the candle to
Someone said that's why it's called the mother tongue. Now, let me just point out again that in this thing of talking too much, many of us in our close relationships do talk too much. And it would be better if we did not talk quite so much. We do not want to die to self. We don't want to die physically. We don't want to die in pride or in our emotions. We don't want to die in taking a second place. We want to appear to be number one. We want to have the last word. It is hard for us to die. But I would like to say that in this way, we come closer to God than in the control of almost any other thing that has to do with the emotions. Because of the fact that Jesus is the word expression of the Father. He is the express image of the Father in many ways. But language is that thing that separates us from the lower animals and brings us closer to God. Let me encourage you to learn how to use to the best advantage this particular matter of the control of language, the control of your words. It is far more important to your spiritual health than you might believe. Question? Fanya's mother? Yes.
And they suggested a fast. Well, they also suggested a word fast. And I went on one this morning. Never in my whole life have I been on a word fast.
Uh-huh.
I fasted until 1:30.
Uh-huh.
And I discovered three things.
All right.
Almost hit every one of them. But a personal testimony.
This is a word fast.
Just a word fast. First, I'm not going to speak at all. It was practical. I decided just to speak only when absolutely necessary.
Yes.
I discovered I don't listen.
Yes.
I'm too busy thinking about what I want to say.
Yes.
I discovered, just like you said, the pride. I want to appear important.
Yes.
Before other people talk. I also discovered that about 95% of what I say is unnecessary.
All right. Three things. I would like to repeat those. During a word fast that lasted, what, about 6 hours?
About that, yes.
That you discovered that you don't listen to other people ordinarily.
Right.
Number two, you speak a large part of the time just for the sheer pride of saying it and the feeling of importance. And the third thing was?
That about 95, maybe even more, 97% of what I say is unimportant.
95 to 97% of what you ordinarily say is unimportant. Well, that would be my evaluation of the way that I generally feel that a lot of what I say I feel could be left off to good advantage. We need to evaluate the way that we talk. When we open our mouths, if it is not for a purpose of edifying someone, or there is a good thing to be accomplished by easing a situation, easing a tense situation by a word, such as, good morning, how are you this morning? All of that is not something that you're really interested in. You're not really interested in expressing any thoughts about the weather, nor are you really interested in inquiring about the other person's health. What you're interested in doing is making a bridge between yourself and someone else. And all of the small talk and passing of the time of day that we do is for that purpose. It is not purposeless talking. So we should not say that just because it is something that we don't expect to have distinct information from that particular conversation, that it is meaningless. It does have meaning in that sense of the word. Now, the mind can be exhausted by some other things, too. One of those things is by music. Now, let's talk a bit about music. I wish we had the rest of the day to address this subject. Music, for us, can be exciting to the point of depleting the electrical energy that we would have available for doing something else. Now, I know that there is a lot today in the way of Christian music that I would judge to be good, that would be uplifting, if it were maybe used 10 or 15 minutes. But when it is used that many hours during the day, I consider it to be exhausting and interfering, and that it would be better if it had been left off. Now, there is much music today that purports to be Christian music that I would not approve of at all. Much of what is considered to be Christian music is nothing more than some kind of sensual music with some kind of Christian words put to it. Most of the time, these Christian words are a mere repetition again and again and again of the same words without any indication that any edification is to be done through that kind of music. I recommend, so far as music is concerned, that you evaluate all music. Church music should be evaluated as well as all other kinds. Hymns. And in addition to that, all kinds of special music given should be evaluated. I have a particular aversion to country-type music given in a religious setting. I have an aversion to rock music given in a Christian setting. My personal bias is against classical music given in a religious setting. Now, I know that for some ears that will be heresy, but maybe those of you who have studied music, as I have for many years, with the idea in mind of making that a profession, you might be able to agree with me. Those of you who have studied music know studied classical music, and that was my field, the field of classical music. At one time, I thought that I might make a career as a concert keyboard artist, but decided to give up music and take instead medicine. But those of you who have studied music as I have, you've studied the lives of the composers. The composers, generally speaking, who compose classical music, their lives are not exemplary Christian lives. I know from personal experience that if you are not a Christian, from your heart cannot come pure Christian music. Therefore, that kind of music that one would expect to receive from a non-Christian person would be expected to arouse emotions that would not be the best for one to feel. Consequently, some years ago, I decided to do away with all the classical music that I had. I recommend that if you are a classicist, as I was, that you evaluate the classical music that you listen to and see if it does not stimulate for you some kind of unwanted emotion or some kind of unwanted attitude toward life, even if it be nothing more than a great deal of pride, because you recognize that, or even you know that you could perform that on a keyboard or a violin or whatever other instrument you might be using for that particular piece of music. Now, music that has an improper effect on the person increases the basal metabolic rate. It will increase the oxygen consumption in the brain as well as in the blood, and it increases respiration. Soothing music, on the other hand, diminishes all of those modalities: oxygen consumption, basal metabolic rate, and respiration.
What about jazz?
Question is about jazz. Jazz, I would put in the same category with rock, and blues in the same category with rock and classical. All of these bring about improper attitudes. If you really love music, you'll understand these things, I think, a lot better than if music is something that you can take or leave. You like it if it's on. If it's not on, you don't miss it. But for those of us for whom music is an intense love, you will find that there are very few types of Christian music that you can truly enjoy in the deepest Christian sense of that term. Now let's go to the next emotion, that these are negative factors on the mind. And the next one that I'd like to talk about is that of deception. Now deception is a very intricate kind of attitude and emotion of the mind. Deception is more likely to occur when you have some other negative emotion. Now let me give you an example of that. Never can the heart be stirred up with envy, with evil surmising, with evil reports, but that the intellect becomes unbalanced and cannot decide correctly any controverted point. In other words, if we have envy or jealousy or anger, hatred, fear, or whatever, any kind of negative emotion, the intellect becomes imbalanced by that strong negative emotion. And then it cannot decide. It cannot judge correctly on any particular point. If you would like a reference for that, the book Emotions, Their Parameters and Measurements. This is published in 1975 by the Raven Press in New York, and it goes into that in some detail. It tells about the influence on the mind of a reduced response to visual stimuli and other stimuli that come into the brain when these negative emotions are present in the person's mind. Now, I wonder if someone would paraphrase what I just said about the emotions and your ability to judge. Who would like to do that? Would you just raise your hand? All right. Would you just paraphrase, just say in your own words what I just said?
Well, I wrote down, if your heart is stirred with envy, jealousy, fear, hatred, anger, and so forth, the intellect becomes unbalanced and cannot make decisions rationally.
That's good. That's very good. How many of you believe that? Could I just see your hands?
Yeah.
All right, I believe that's pretty much unanimous. Now, deception is a thing that probably every one of us here has had some dealings with in the past. We may even now be laboring under deception. And consequently, we need to be very humble about our attitudes and what we think we know. Let's just turn in the Bible to the book of John. In the book of John, in chapter 7, there are several very important things that can help us to see some things concerning deception that can make us wary. Let's take a look at John 7 and verse 12. Now, before we start reading, I would like to tell you that the people that we will be reading about are some of the best men who ever lived on the face of the earth. They were generous. They were prosperous. They were churchgoers. They kept the Sabbath. They were punctilious in it. You would love having one of these people as your neighbor. If you worked in the church with one of these, you would enjoy being a church member with them. They were hard workers in the church. So far as churchmanship was concerned, they were hard workers in the church. They knew the scriptures. They also, that is, they knew certain of the scriptures. They could just bless your heart with their knowledge of the scriptures. They could expound on these. In fact, they loved doing so. Even in public places, anywhere you met them, they would be willing to stop and expound on the scriptures to you. They could quote large parts of the Bible. These were fine men. They were some of the best men who have ever lived on the face of the earth. Do not get me wrong. These were not criminals. Do not understand in an improper way about these men about whom we'll be reading. These were not criminal men, men that you would have looked at them and hated them the moment you laid eyes on them. Not so. That's not the kind of people we're talking about. These are people who were good men, respectable, dignified, educated, honorable men. Now let's read here what we find. I'm sure you understand we're going to be talking about the Pharisees. From a worldly standpoint, everything that I have said is true about these men. Let's just read John 7 and verse 12. Let's start with verse 11. Then the Jews sought him at the feast and said, "Where is he?" And there was much discussion or murmuring among the people concerning him. For some said, "He is a good man." Others said, "Nay, but he deceiveth the people." Who was right? Were those good men who said that he was a good man, were they the good ones? Or were those the good men who said, "No, he deceives the people"? Well, the great weight of evidence inside the church at that time, inside of Christ's church at that time, was on the side of those who said, "Nay, he deceiveth the people." Now let's turn on over to verses 39 to 43. Jesus had just told them that if a man thirst, let him come unto me. Verse 39, but this spake he of the Spirit, which they that believe on him should receive, for the Holy Ghost was not yet given, because that Jesus was not yet glorified. You see, Pentecost had not yet fully come. They yet had many days to go, about 55 days yet to go, from the time of the feast until the time that Pentecost would occur. And so the Holy Spirit had to, the pouring out of the Holy Spirit had to await the time of Pentecost. Verse 40, many of the people therefore, when they heard this saying, said, of a truth, this is the prophet. Others said, this is the Christ. But some said, shall Christ come out of Galilee? Hath not the scripture said that Christ cometh of the seed of David and out of the town of Bethlehem where David was? So there was a division among the people because of him. A deception had taken hold of them and they were deceived. I'd like to give you several reasons why people become deceived. Number one is because of prenatal development. I believe that we can be set up for deceptions before we're born by the disbelief of our parents before us and the thoughts that they have, the errors and occult relationships that they might have had before our birth. These can have an influence on us and on the development of the brain, so that certain parts of the brain can be weak. Now the second thing is previous thoughts and experience. This also will have an influence on the mind and can determine to some degree whether or not we're going to have a deception. The third thing is desire from the limbic system. This desire can be in the form of envy or jealousy. Some of those things that we have already said, fear or anxiety, fear of loss of a coveted position. These desires from the limbic system can have an influence on the brain in such a way that we become deceived. Item number four, the blinding effects from Satan. I believe that Satan is quite capable of keeping his hand over information so that we cannot receive it. And I'd like to give you an example. When I grew up as a little girl, we had quite a great deal of Bible reading in my home. When I got to high school, I began to have an inordinate love for those things that had to do with education and came under the influence of some of my close relatives who were highly educated and were great ones for idealizing the Greek influence, Greek and Roman influence, but especially Greek, on our lives. The whole tenor of my life began to go in another direction, and pretty soon I did not believe what the Bible said. I believed that there was nothing in the Bible that had any validity, that it was just not even worth having a Bible in your home. Consequently, I got rid of all the Bibles that I had, and for years there was no Bible in my home. Then the time came when I studied the Bible. It was not because I had any desire to study the Bible that I opened its pages again, but rather because of a social obligation which I had. This social obligation led me to study the Bible, and I began to be interested in it. So I studied week after week after week with some people. And I remember one time that our teacher said, now we have studied thus and such, and I was the one who had studied in this particular group longer than anyone else, and he particularly said, I studied with you such and such thing. I don't remember what that was now, but I said, no, I don't know anything about that. He said, didn't we study such and such thoughts? And I said, no, we didn't study that. And I was adamant, we didn't study that. I knew that we had not studied it. I'd always been a good student, and I'd been attentive during these studies, and so I knew we had not studied them. So he would launch into the study again, because he'd say, well, this we need before we study certain other prophecies or get into some types of history. So we'd start in with a study again, the one that he had said we'd already had. And when he would give illustrations, I would remember the illustrations that he had used to illustrate the Bible texts. And I knew that I had studied that lesson. We had this many times, probably four times, that he would say, we have studied this before, and I would be certain that we had not. And after we had done this about four times, I began to lose confidence in my ability to remember these Bible topics. So one day, I questioned him about that. I asked him what he thought was the reason why I could not remember what things we had studied. He said that he thought that Satan had put his hand over certain information so that I would not be able to remember it. And to this day, I don't have any better explanation than that. How I would just forget whole topics in the Bible. I found many of these things to be somewhat unfamiliar, although I thought I knew the Bible backward and forward, having grown up in a home where it was often read and having studied it in high school and in college as literature. But I came to find out that I knew very little about the Bible, hardly more than the meaning of Genesis and some of the stories like Noah and the flood. Yes? Yes. I know I'm wrong, but I still think I'm right. Well, this kind of thing, the blinding of Satan, can lead us to positions that we hold on to rather doggedly because we believe, we trust in our minds. But we must not trust in our minds when the Bible says something different from what we're believing. Yes.
The observations we've almost put in the words now that I've come up. Sure. But this would be example by what we said earlier.
Uh-huh.
Many times music or forms of entertainment that we have read and been counseled from a spiritual standpoint is not for our best good. We would not discern if the devil could follow that. We would not discern if those things were part of that.
Yes.
And so perhaps sometimes, as in our Christian growth, we could look back.
Yes.
And through the mercy of God, we could see, yes, that was harmful to me. That was not harmful to me, but I did not see it.
Yes. We have to make our education step by step by step. It's just like our Christian conversion. It has to be a process. That's the process of education. And we can go back to what we've already talked about, and that is that certain emotions in the mind can block out large bits of information that we could get. If a fellow worker has jealousy or envy or anger or whatever, any of these emotions, that worker then becomes a poor judge of another worker about whom the jealousy or envy or anger occurs. He is a poor judge of the quality of the work of that individual. So if you want to have somebody give a reference for you, don't select somebody who is envious or jealous of you. They may be a very poor judge of your character or of the type of work that you have. And in a church relationship, people may not even be able to discern whether or not you're a Christian. And especially if they disagree with your Christian principles and standards, they may think that you're not even a Christian because of the fact that they have some resentment or some dislike of you. Now, the finest discussion of how to cure the mind that I have found is in a book called The Ministry of Healing. Some of you have this book, and I'd like to recommend that you read the chapter on mind cure. It begins on page 241. Let me just read some of the very fine things that you will find in this particular chapter. The relation that exists between the mind and the body is very intimate. When one is affected, the other sympathizes. Many of the diseases from which men suffer are the result of mental depression, grief, anxiety, discontent, remorse, guilt, distrust. These all tend to break down the life forces and to invite decay and death. Now, that's just what we've been talking about. And the many references that I have given you from the current medical literature tell this very thing, how grief intensifies the negative physiologic responses that people have, can invite death and decay. Now, when we speak of decay, what kind of diseases is a person referring to? What would you classify this whole category of diseases of decay? We've got a word for that. Do you know what that is? Well, we call them degenerative diseases. What are they? Let's just give a list of them. Arthritis, cancer. Cancer is also classified as a malignant disease. Emphysema is a physical, we could classify emphysema and asthma as degenerative diseases. Osteoporosis. Heart disease is the biggest one, and you've hit all around it. And high blood pressure and diabetes, all of these are diseases of deterioration or decay, and they bring on death. Now, disease is sometimes produced and is often greatly aggravated by the imagination. There are many people who, when they think they are sick, they become sick. This is a physiologic response. We studied about that yesterday when we studied about opioids and those kinds of things that are present always in the brain in response to thoughts. Now listen to this. Courage, hope, faith, sympathy, love promote health and prolong life. A contented mind, a cheerful spirit is health to the body and strength to the soul. Proverbs 17:22 says, "A rejoicing heart doeth good like a medicine." Now let's just take another one of these. It is not God's purpose that any human being should yield his mind to the will and will to the control of another, becoming a passive instrument in his hands. No one is to merge his individuality in that of another. He is not to look to any human being as the source of healing. His dependence must be in God. In the dignity of his God-given manhood, he is to be controlled by God himself, not by any human intelligence. Now let's just discuss that particular thing a little bit. What do you think that means when it is not God's purpose that any human being should yield his mind and will to the control of another, becoming a passive instrument in his hands? All right, if you go to the physician and he says, you have X disease, and the treatment is thus and such, and with not a single thought, you take whatever is offered, and the medicine, you're on the way with the medicine. Let me tell you what you should do when you faith, when you face this kind of situation, you should procure a copy of Physician's Desk Reference. Now, that particular volume will tell you about both over-the-counter as well as prescription medications, the contraindications, the indications, the cautions, the side effects of drugs. Sometimes several pages will be involved in discussing these particular things about drugs.
Dr. Brass, yes. An easier way to get that, having come from a drug salesman background, every doctor that gives you prescriptions in the office, little samples, he will have an official package insert with the samples themselves.
Uh-huh.
Ask him to give you the official package insert because that is merely what's printed in the PDR.
Yes.
For that particular drug.
Yes. The package inserts are also available, and they will tell you everything that's in the PDR, including the contraindications. Yes?
I don't know about other states, but Texas now requires that when the prescription is filled on the computer at the drug, that if you ask for it, they can come to school and send you all that data.
That sounds good. Yes? That's in Proverbs 17:22. A rejoicing heart doeth good like a medicine. Now let's just talk a little bit more about the individuality, merging the individuality into the life of another. What other things can you think of that represent merging the individuality? Yes, Lisa.
And then she started asking me to do things, I do them, and so forth. But then, one thing I didn't really realize until I again had time to think and recall about what happened was that she did have control over my mind,
mm-hmm.
and it was, and it hurt. Even though mm-hmm. she may not have realized it,
mm-hmm.
as I think about it now, she did
mm-hmm.
have control over my mind. Also, I'm speaking of my father. Also, my father's a psychologist, and
mm-hmm.
he specializes in hypnosis and neuro-linguistic programming.
Mm-hmm.
And one way of getting the mind, you know, is through hypnosis. And my dad has tried several times to hypnotize me, but I've trained
mm-hmm.
to help me. But it's important to try and realize.
Mm-hmm. Yes. One can be hypnotized even when when the hypnotist is not going through the usual, the routine methods like the darkened room and the fixed eyes and the sound of the voice being that thing that one is told to focus on. Eve was hypnotized by the tree, wasn't she? Hypnotized and yielded her will to the will of the tempter. And I believe that there are a lot of things that have an hypnotic influence. Food has an hypnotic influence on people. And interpersonal, intersexual relationships also have a hypnotizing influence often. Yes?
Regarding all generalizations are false.
Mm-hmm. All generalizations are false, including this one. That was the statement made. All right.
Parents, I don't know how to describe what they do. They have such a power over children.
Yes.
That power is
perverted. Yes.
I asked my parents growing up, but they also came up in the same situation. They didn't know any better.
Yes.
Yes.
One can yield the individuality and blend this into the life of another so that one becomes merely the shadow of someone else. And this is always destructive. It is destructive to both parties. Yes?
Another one is sometimes...
Speak loud enough that they can hear you in the back.
The reverse of that is true, too. If a parent doesn't realize that this has been going on in their young life, they become, not only do it to their children, but the children can do it to them as a learned thing.
Yes.
Also, another area is such as husband-wife church relations.
Yes. Husband-wife merging of the personality is quite common. This kind of thing of the wife giving absolute submission to the husband is also fosters this kind of thing. I'm sure you're aware that there is a good bit of this kind of deception afoot today, where the wife is told that her husband is the head of the family and she must submit regardless of whether she has some alternate views or conflicting views that she has convictions about. Yes?
I think a very unique form of spiritism we are seeing today is coming into various churches who are teaching an absolute dictatorial chain of command.
Mm-hmm.
And where the members of the church are to be in complete absolute subjection to church leaders, and the wives are to be complete absolute subjection to their parents, to their husbands, and the children are being complete absolute subjection to their parents.
Yes.
And I think that what this is doing is setting up a number of evangelical Protestant churches for mass hypnosis, as we see the final issues of Revelation chapter 13 come to play for people in the world to follow men. And the Lord is so specifically told us not to make flesh our arm.
Yes.
We should be in subjection one to another, but in the Lord.
Yes. Subjection one to another in the Lord. And this matter of parents being absolutely in control of their children, husbands absolutely in control of their wives, leaders of any kind, whether it be in industry or in church or in education or wherever, in the office, those who are leaders being to be followed by the underlings without question, that kind of thing can set one up for an autocratic society, for mass hypnosis. Was there other discussion on this thing of individuality? On the next page in Ministry of Healing is the thing that Dane Griffin brought out, where it says, when he talked about the physician, it says, there is something better for us to engage in than the control of humanity by humanity. The physician should educate the people to look from the human to the divine. Instead of teaching the sick to depend upon human beings for the cure of soul and body, he should direct them to the one who can save to the uttermost all who come unto him. He who made man's mind knows what the mind needs. God alone is the one who can heal. That was on page 243 of Ministry of Healing. Isn't that a good quote?
What that does, too, is we work with people and see when they realize that they have the ability of themselves to treat their illnesses, it lifts such a burden off their shoulders. Because it costs so much to get medical care.
Yes.
And it's such a burden to think that they're being controlled by someone else.
Yes.
That it frees them to have these positive emotions back again.
Yes.
Which frees their bodies even more to heal themselves.
Quite true, yes. Yes.
You know, thinking about Medicare now, is she in this way, would be better than even having any health insurance, something like that?
Okay. Statement was made that if you live this way, it would be better that you not have health insurance. I don't know that I can make a statement on that. I don't have any conscientious feelings about health insurance. That would be either for or against. On page 244 is a section on sympathy. And I'd like to talk with you some about people whose hearts have been wounded. And that includes a lot of people. People's hearts are wounded by a number of different kinds of things, such things as um, problems with a child, such problems as a child running away from home, or a child being sick, or other things of that nature. A person who has had a marital conflict, especially one that results in separation or divorce, these individuals need to be treated tenderly. They need to be worked with in a very special way. Let me read this from page 244. Great wisdom is needed in dealing with diseases caused through the mind. A sore, sick heart, a discouraged mind needs mild treatment. Many times, some living home trouble is like a canker eating to the very soul and weakening the life force. And sometimes it is the case that remorse for sin undermines the constitution and unbalances the mind. It is through tender sympathy that this class of invalids can be benefited. The physician should first gain their confidence and then point them to the great healer. If their faith can be directed to the true physician and they can have confidence that he has undertaken their case, this will bring relief to the mind and often give health to the body. Sympathy and tact will often prove a greater benefit to the sick than will the most skillful treatment given in a cold, indifferent way. Now let's skip some. Let's skip to page 246 of this chapter. Not through the excitement or oblivion produced by unnatural or unhelpful stimulants, not through indulgence of the lower appetites or passions is to be found true healing or refreshment for the body or the soul. After bereavement or grief, certain types of recreation are just undesirable. I remember a young couple whose father died, and the young couple, the father of the young man, died, and the young couple insisted on taking the widow, the mother, on a trip to see Disneyland and a number of exciting amusements. They said that would just perk her up a great deal. And I counseled very much against that kind of thing, but they took her anyway. I don't know what the result of it was. I know that it took her a year to get over her grief, and I sometimes feel that we get a wrong attitude about what is going to bring about recovery from such things as grief. It is not stimulants. It is not indulgence of the lower appetites or passions that we get a true healing or refreshment for the body or the soul. Now, one other thing, and that's on page 249. This has to do with the emotions. Now, we have studied a number of emotions today: fear, anger, grief, sadness, anxiety, exhaustion of the mind by talking, and exciting music and deception. We've studied all of those today. But I'd like to bring this paragraph to you from page 249 of Ministry of Healing. It is not wise to look to ourselves and study our emotions, our own personal emotions, and our reactions to them, and do I like them or do I not like them. We should study to see if we are having wrong emotions. If we do this, that is, if we look to ourselves and study our emotions and sympathize with ourselves, if we do this, the enemy will present difficulties and temptations that weaken faith and destroy courage. Closely to study our emotions and give way to our feelings is to entertain doubt and entangle ourselves in perplexity. We are to look away from self to Jesus. And that brings me to the point of discussing biofeedback. Biofeedback and transcendental meditation and a number of other things of this nature, these matters, these therapeutic modalities, are not, in my opinion, Christian modalities. They tend to turn the thoughts inward, and in this regard are no better than Eastern meditations that are the hallmark of pagan religions. So I would recommend to you that you not be associated with these types of things, transcendental meditation and biofeedbacks. Now, I don't doubt that there may not be some parts of biofeedback that could be beneficial. A lot of times I have people who tell me that there are parts of that that are beneficial. There may be. But generally speaking, I think that anything that makes us focus attention on our own emotions and our own reactions is not beneficial. Now, there are probably questions, and if so, I'd like to take them now. Your question. Okay, the question is about group therapy as such, and you're correct, I do not have a good feeling about group therapy. Now, let me tell you several reasons why I don't. One thing is that often these group therapy sessions tend to be somewhat bordering on secret societies. And having come out of the Eastern Star and the Masonic Lodge background, I recognize that that is classified as a secret society does not have anything about it per se that any one of us would not be very happy to study. Take the Eastern Star. There isn't anything in the Eastern Star. If you take just that one item alone, that anybody would consider to be secret at all. It is the system that is secret. My feeling is that Christians should be entirely open and free in the sharing of information. My personal opinion is that except for large commercial concerns producing things like meat substitutes, that we should be entirely free and open with our recipes, so that when you go downtown to eat in our vegetarian restaurant and you eat something there that you like and you would like to have the recipe for it, our business is that of teaching people how to cook those things that we have. An attitude of entire openness is that of the Christian, I believe. Second reason why I feel that group therapy is not the best is that it does tend to focus on the emotions and to turn the thoughts inward to make it so that one analyzes my reaction to what my husband did or said, what I like about him and what I do not like, and whether or not it was really a mistake for me to marry him or not. And if mistake, I'm saddled with him and I'll have to make the best that I can of it. I feel that no such attitudes as that should ever in any way, either subtly or openly, be suggested. And in some group therapy sessions, at least with psychiatrists, that does often come up, that people are not matched. Their personality types are not matched well. And therefore, they're probably going to have rough sledding of it in their marriage. Item number three in my reason for preferring not to use group therapy sessions, is that the airing of the emotions, the restating of things that have happened, intensify the thoughts that the person has about those. In private psychology and psychiatry sessions, I am opposed to the couch type affair. I feel that when a therapist is working with someone who is who needs assistance in the way of counseling, that the therapist should hear the smallest amount possible of the problem. To restate the problem intensifies the feelings that one has about it. We have good counsel on that in the spirit of prophecy, that it is not wise for the therapist to encourage the person who is being counseled to air their feelings or to tell of their bizarre experiences. Yes?
The Bible says it is a sin to speak of those things which are done of that sin.
Yes.
And I think that it's important for counseling to identify root problems.
Yes.
Root problems.
Yes, root problems like bitterness. Yes.
Root problems of this nature.
Anger, envy, fear, distrust.
The basic areas of character deficiencies.
Character deficiencies.
Not details.
Not details and not individuals. We tend to label people and also to distrust or to disrespect those who have certain problems. Yes. Okay, the question is, what is transcendental meditation? It is that thing of trying to achieve an exalted state by through techniques of meditation.
And the one that they can transport themselves to somewhere as well there.
That's right. That's right. Transporting themselves into a higher state of being.
And the first time I had I was feeling sick, so it would appear as if I was not maybe listening to what's happening around me because I had feeling sick, and two of them were brothers, and these were brethren of me, two of the faith. And they were discussing the joy that they experienced in this place.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't believe that.
Yes,
we
should not, I believe, have anything to do with that. Question.
Amen.
All right, the question is about marriage encounter, group sessions, and the like. I don't doubt that a lot of good is done, but my personal feeling is that if the couple would spend the time that they spend in the sessions with Adventist Home, Child Guidance, in a place where they can sit and read together and relax together, that would be time better spent. That's my personal opinion of that. Yes. Yes. Yes, that, in fact, that's so important. I'd like to restate that the true therapy is therapy that we have with the Lord, in which we bring our problems before the Lord, and He is our therapist.
Amen.
Handle.
We know that he was not a converted man when he wrote that. I felt from that there were times when God gave inspiration to unconverted people, maybe for the purpose of converting them, but that there could be inspired material come to an unconverted mind at times.
Okay, the question is, can inspired material come through an unconverted mind at times? And no question about it, Shakespeare had a lot of gems, but that does not mean that we would need to read Shakespeare in order to get those gems, even though he has stated some principles of life and some of the most magnificent ways to wade through all the other to get to those few gems, I think would not be. That's an unfair question, and I appreciate it. Yes.
comment and question. Comment in relationship to what Nancy just said.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus said, come ye that are labored and heavy laden, and I will give you rest.
Yes.
Then the question.
Matthew 11:28-30.
Then the question, are you familiar with LEAD, lead consultant, and neurolinguistics, and would you be able to make an observation if you are familiar on that and the
I'm familiar with neurolinguistics. I'm not familiar with LEADS, leads.
LEAD.
No, lead consultants. What are they?
Well, that is the professional name of this organization that utilizes the approach of the emotions that they're showing through body language
uh-huh.
so that people who are healthy and be aware of these things that you talked about.
Uh-huh.
And being able to get directly at what is bothering the person, not on the surface, you know, they will say certain things that are superficial, but
yeah.
be able to lead them through one of the questions,
mm-hmm.
what is really the base of what is disturbing them.
Yes. Techniques of this kind can be helpful, but nothing takes the place of minute-by-minute counseling between the therapist and the Holy Spirit as the person is being counseled. So the counselor should have a direct communication with the Holy Spirit and be in good physical condition so that the mind can hear the still small voice. And the physical condition, I can't overemphasize.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.